You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of October 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
I feel that it is my duty as a woman, as a mother, a human being, and as an American citizen, to speak out and tell the truth about what happened to me.
Within hours of Donald Trump claiming in the final debate that nobody respects women more bigly than he does, yet another woman comes forward begging to differ. My guests Mary Dajewski and Kathleen Burke will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including America's post-Trump political landscape and what it might look like, Iceland's counterintuitive emergence as a holiday hotspot, and...
Because Brexit means Brexit. And we're going to make a success of it.
Britain's ongoing attempts to figure out what it voted for in June. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and Mary Dajewski, columnist for The Independent and The Guardian. Welcome both. And we will start with last night's third and mercifully final presidential debate between Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton and her orange Republican rival Donald Trump. It went much as might have been expected, i.e. that Trump said a bunch of things which, while crass, outrageous and or demonstrably untrue, have attracted all the subsequent headlines, while Clinton's efforts to discuss anything resembling policy or reality have languished largely unreported. Mary, first of all, is it imaginable at this point that there were any undecided voters watching last night? Has anyone had their mind changed? Who are these people?
I doubt that many will have had their minds changed, but one thing that struck me was how Hillary had really learnt to do debates. I mean, the Hillary of the third debate was really much more, almost less tutored, more spontaneous. She didn't have the sort of false expression on her face. There wasn't the additional smile. She seemed at times a bit too tutored, but my goodness, I mean, the experience of two debates really, I mean, it seemed to me she handled it vastly better than the rest. And Donald Trump, of course, that was a whole different story.
She does look a lot more confident, possibly because she's reading the same polls that we are. Kathleen, the big headline afterwards was Trump's refusal to commit to respect the result. And there has been a further development on this, which he has now said that he will accept the results of the presidential election if he wins, which is big of him, or even bigly of him. He's also said he would accept a clear election result, but I would also reserve the right to file a legal challenge. Where is he going with this? I genuinely don't. I mean, there's almost nothing I do understand about the Trump campaign, I will concede, but I really don't understand this at all.
Well, of course, the saying he will accept it if he wins is not one iota different from saying he won't accept it, or he will let us know if he accepts it. And even his daughter Ivanka, whom everyone thinks is absolutely terrific, clever and so forth, says, of course, they will accept it. So I don't quite know where he's going. I mean, if you look, I mean, everyone has pointed out that, look at Al Gore, for example, he accepted what was a decision.
Eventually, in fairness, though, he did mount a legal challenge, as was his right to do, I suppose.
Yes, but once it was decided, he didn't query it. So if Trump mounts a legal challenge, well, good luck to him. It's hard to know what he was going to challenge it by. How do you rig an election that takes place in 50 states and anywhere between 12 and 75 or 80 constituencies? I'd like to see that. The organization of the Democrats is becoming legendary, but even they, I don't think, have the troops on the ground to do that sort of thing. It's going to be very difficult. Even if he gets wiped out remember George McGovern, and he took two states, that's all.
One state, I think. One state in the District of Columbia,
No,
I think,
he took
McGovern.
His own state. Did he not take Massachusetts
he
and
did.
Dakotas?
He,
and Dakota
know,
was
he,
one of his.
No, he didn't win the Dakotas.
Oh, well.
We were looking this up earlier, talking about this stuff. There have been two 49-state wipeouts, 72 and 84.
Well, all right, then I will bow to your quite clearly superior knowledge. I was working on the index card in my brain. We won't get that. We won't get that. But if you look at what's interesting, I've been keeping an eye on various poll challenges, not challenges, but differences. And if you look at the states that and what their electoral votes are, their electoral votes, it's getting closer and closer to just the smaller and smaller numbers of states. So he could take essentially the Louisiana Purchase, you know, the great middle part of the United States, but he still wouldn't win.
Mary, as we heard at the top of the show, in the last few hours, yet another woman has come forward with a depressingly plausible tale of impropriety, to put it charitably, by Donald Trump. There was a moment last night when Donald Trump declared, I think, you know, with his usual lack of proportion, that no one respects women more than he does, at which point the crowd actually laughed. Was that a significant telling moment? Is this, of all the manifold defects that Donald Trump has, is it possible that this is actually the thing that has done for him?
I tend to think that indeed it is what's done for him. I thought that he was able to survive pretty much everything else. But this is so contrary to the spirit of the times. I mean, whatever happened, whether it did happen, whether it didn't happen, it almost doesn't matter. And the fact that the other candidate is a woman sort of brings this into additional relief. And I mean, if I was the Democrat campaign, I'd might make sure I had one of these every day until the election.
A bit of nuance there, I think. There is the question of what you say you're going to vote and what you actually do when you get into the voting place. There are probably an awful lot of men who actually slightly envy him if he's able to get away with this.
This is always, I have that faint, queasy suspicion myself that to a lot of people, Trump appeals not despite this stuff, but actually because of it.
Think of Billy Bush.
Well, indeed. He's not alone, unfortunately. Almost unanimously reported this debate as another win for Hillary Clinton, 3 out of 3. Kathleen, does it make a difference at this point?
Well, it does, in the sense it probably solidifies those who already back her, gives them the confidence that she's actually going to win. I have no idea how many undecided votes there are, but I should have thought they were, you know, angels on the tip of a pin. Those who don't like her don't like her. Those Republicans who are swaying in that direction might actually consolidate it. Those who don't like her don't like her. But I think one thing, it was striking last night in the middle of the night when I was sitting along with, you know, as was Mary, clearly, trying hard to keep awake. It wasn't hard to keep awake because it was such an exciting bullfight. I don't know. She looked presidential.
Yes, I felt she looked presidential almost for the first time.
Yes. I mean, we must remember she was actually a public prosecutor and a lawyer in Arkansas. This didn't come as entirely new to her, but she's been so concerned about making sure she doesn't say anything that's wrong. And I agree with you entirely, Mary. I don't know whether she loosened up. Maybe it's her confidence as well, but she did look like someone who could run the country and whom Americans could be proud of.
Yep. I also thought that almost for the first time that when she was speaking about women's issues and she was speaking about abortion. And, you know, I thought, you know, this is America, where abortion, Roe v. Wade, you know, these are sort of huge emblematic issues. And I felt she really, you know, that was almost, I thought, when you possibly saw the real Hillary Clinton behind everything, practically for the first time, maybe in her career.
That she cared.
Yeah.
And she was willing to say she cared, and she didn't care if people didn't care.
Well, let's move along now to a related subject. It's hopefully not tempting fate too far to start wondering what happens to American politics after Trump. Even if he does lose as badly as polls suggest he will, this guy isn't going away.
Let's say Donald Trump gets elected, he's in office for 4 years. If he don't do anything but close the border with Mexico, that will increase the level of security in the United States tremendously. If we don't get control of our borders, we're going to have domestic civil war in this country. We're going to have terrorism, people blowing up buses and things like that and killing people.
That is one William Carter, who, in addition to appearing to model his hairstyle after Donald Trump, takes all sorts, also publishes a newspaper called Conservative Action Report, and a riveting read it is. There is, of course, no evidence to suggest that America's border with Mexico has any real connection to Islamist terrorism or a potential civil war, but that's kind of the point. Mary, there are echoes here of the Brexit debate, such as it was, when people talk about Trump's fans. There's this phrase, the legitimate concern that must be addressed. Where does politicians, or where should politicians, stop addressing their political concern, their legitimate concerns rather, and just tell people, you know what, you're wrong. Your concerns are ridiculous. Knock it off.
I think that is the way that we Remainers lost the Brexit referendum in the UK, by being so complacent. And maybe we did say that people were wrong, and we continue to say that people are wrong.
But what if they are?
But I don't think that matters. I think that if people believe that they're right, and also when you look at their particular circumstances, if you were in those same circumstances, you might think in a very similar way.
Well, but this is the question of what circumstances they're in. I'm sure you've seen the research which suggests that Trump supporters are actually not this kind of monolith of marginalised, left-behind, white working class people. They're actually on average a bit better off than most. They have a median household income of $72,000, which is not a fortune in modern America, but it's certainly far from the poverty line. Kathleen, this question is based in a pet suspicion of mine, and it applies just as much to the Brexit debate here as well. What if these people are not actually angry about anything? What if they just enjoy being angry?
Well, it's not unimaginable. Some people enjoy being happy. Some people enjoy being pumped up, as we now know that a word of Trump's. I think probably that's not quite the case. If you look out, well, enjoy being angry. I think a lot of males enjoy feeling strong, and they enjoy following a quarterback who's strong, and they enjoy being part of a mass of strong men. I mean, I don't know. I'll have to ask you about that.
I was never much of a team player.
You're a journalist,
yeah,
obviously.
To the immense relief of any team I was ever selected in, I have to say.
The point is they're part of a group, aren't they? They're part of a group they see as massively important, as massively strong. There was, in one of the things I read today, this really rather huge man with his baseball cap backwards holding up Trump, a man who has balls. Now, that, in a funny sort of way, are you going to beat me out there? in a way, I think possibly sums up what I'm trying to say.
But this is a pet theory of mine, which, like most of my pet theories, is almost certainly dreadfully flawed. But I do think that social media especially has enabled the kind of conversion of outrage to sort of a hobby, really, for a lot of people. I think people really enjoy it. I think they enjoy the adrenaline rush, that sanctimonious thrill of thinking you're part of some sort of doomed heroic cause.
Well, I think if you transferred that to Britain, then you would say this was the conversation that everybody used to have in pubs and down at the football or whatever. But it never got any further. So the groups that you were talking about were really relatively small. Now the groups are gigantic because you can go on social media and you are part of your particular constellation is right there, and you can contribute to it. You can appreciate that there are like-minded people out there, and that strengthens the whole thing.
Kathleen, how do the what lesson, I guess, should both parties learn from this? Because presumably both the Republicans and the Democrats fear that there might be a similar figure to Donald Trump, but one maybe more palatable to other groups as well, maybe who is able to reach out to women, to black people, to Hispanics, and is actually able to pull together the sort of coalition that could win the White House. Because I don't think the Democrats are immune from this. I don't have a hard time imagining some other celebrity Yahoo, a Michael Moore figure, or a Kanye West, or a Susan Sarandon deciding they fancy a pop at this.
A Denzel Washington.
Take your pick. But what can the parties do if they're determined to leave the process of choosing their candidate to the people? How can they, I guess, insulate American democracy from demagogues?
Well, they can't. They just have to hope that the people will also stomp on it themselves, as we hoped was going to happen in this election. I mean, the Republicans need more people on the ground, and the Democrats need a better control of social media, in the sense that if the other party comes up with this sort of weird and wonderful person, they can actually do something about it. But you can't. I mean, that's the problem with democracy, isn't it? It sometimes comes up with things you don't like.
But I think one of the things about an American presidential campaign especially is that these are like sort of almost like medieval tournaments. There's trials by trials by trials.
That's and very good.
You have to survive. Each one, you have to emerge the survivor or victorious or whatever. And I think the interesting thing about Trump is that he's survived until now. And if he fails at the last, he will have failed in a way, in his own terms, in a heroic way, because he's surmounted every obstacle that was thrown at him, and then he fails at the last. And I think, you know, it really is up to the American voters to judge whether he's suited to the office. And that, you know, that was one of the questions asked during the debate, and that I imagine may be at the forefront of a lot of people's minds when they go to vote.
But just to follow that up, Mary, does the Republican Party in particular have an existential problem because of this? Because they have now had two primary seasons in a row which have been chimpanzees tea parties. They have been absolutely preposterous circuses, which in this case as well had an ultimately preposterous result. Is there anything they can or should do to stop that from happening in 2020?
But you see, it's interesting that you mentioned the Tea Party, because we've almost forgotten about the Tea Party.
That's what's known as a dog whistle, I'm afraid.
Trump has sort of managed to bring together a coalition that has sort of negated the Tea Party by pushing the Republicans to a place where the Tea Party sort of was and some of the party sort of was. But I think I may be wrong about this, but I think maybe the demographics of the United States as they are going to put traditional Republicans on the back foot. And this is going to be a long-term trend. And that, so insofar as they're backed into a corner, then these are the sort of candidates that they will choose to lash out and get them out of it.
Just one point is that the historian in me speaks up. Let's not forget 1964, when it was Goldwater. Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. Moderation in the defense of liberty is no virtue. And it tore apart then, and not quite so bad as now, but it tore apart then. And they pulled it back together. So I think it depends on how long your long term is, I think.
That's true enough. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, Mary Dejewski and Kathleen Burke. Coming up next, the UK begins to understand what it has let itself in for.
It's the show presented by me, Andrew Tuck, all about the cities we live in. The show that celebrates urban living, from tough-talking mayors and civic activists to the guy who runs a perfect neighbourhood shop and the woman who, come sunset, turns into a gorilla gardener. The Urbanist is the go-to show for anyone who wants to know what makes a great city, and also a rubbish one, and how good lighting or wise technology could shape their metropolis for the better. Join us every week for sparkling debate, global reports, and some agenda-setting interviews.
We have a chance to shape what the urban environment will be like for billions of people.
The show premieres live every Thursday, or you can subscribe to the program as a podcast at Moncourt.com or on SoundCloud or iTunes. The Urbanist, the program that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
Hello. Have we been introduced properly? We should get to know each other a bit better. We're Monocle 24, the radio station brought to you from the makers of Monocle magazine, the global print title that was launched in 2007 to deliver a briefing on everything from affairs to design. Headquartered in London, Monocle has built up a network of bureaux in Tokyo, Singapore, Hong Kong, Istanbul, New York, and Toronto. And we also run our own stores and cafes, where you can get a good coffee, a nice cake, and a copy of the magazine, too. Then there's Monocle.com, where you can listen to this radio station and all our archived shows, watch the films made by our film team, and visit our e-commerce store. Intrigued? I just knew we'd get along.
This is Midori House, live from London. I'm Andrew Muller. Still with me are Mary Dejewski and Kathleen Burke. Now, getting on for 4 months since the UK narrowly voted against remaining part of the European Union, there remains little consensus vis-a-vis exactly what the UK voted for. Amid the ongoing wrangle between so-called hard Brexit and soft Brexit, or as some have suggested, dog's Brexit, Theresa May has kicked off her first Brussels summit as Prime Minister by promising that the UK will continue to, quote, work closely, end quote, with the EU after Britain takes back control. Mary, do we as yet have the impression that anybody actually has any idea how this is going to work at all?
No, I get the impression that the insofar as there are leaks and statements of whatever, all idea. One of the really interesting things about politics in the UK at the moment is the whole idea that there's been for years and years and years that politicians in the government should be on message. That's just vanished. People are as near as possible at each other's throats, almost in public and sometimes in public. And so there seems to be absolutely no consensus inside the cabinet about what this country's got itself into.
Kathleen, Theresa May says she wants, again, I quote, a smooth, constructive, orderly Brexit. I mean, I want a tap that dispenses 1986 Grange Hermitage. Is she going to get that?
I hope not. It'll be much more fun for the rest of us if she doesn't. I cannot see how she's going to whip into line the Tory party on this, not to mention the SNP and Liberals who are waking up and so forth, and a good chunk of the Labour Party. How she's going to be able to do this if it continues to be uncomfortably hard, I cannot think. I must say, Mary might have more of an idea.
See, but this is another thing. I just want to see politicians stand up and say, it'd be brilliant if someone says, look, we've looked into this whole Brexit thing. It's too hard. You know, we're not. It'll take years. It'll be expensive. It'll be boring. And we're not doing it.
Well, just in the last 24 hours, I've heard two things. One of them is speculation that Theresa May is actually going for a, quote, soft Brexit. You know, how easily we slip into these wonderful new terms. But it will actually be dressed up as a hard Brexit to keep the rest of the party on side. Now, I'm not sure whether that's possible. The other theory that I've heard, and I actually don't subscribe to this, but it's becoming a sort of almost received wisdom now, that the more the economy goes down, the more the fear project is shown actually to have been justified, people will actually change their mind, and that stalwarts of the Leave campaign at the popular level, if not among the senior politicians, will actually turn around and say, save us from this dreadful mess, and we'll change sides. Now, I'm not convinced about that, because I think the immigration vote was so strong that people won't actually switch sides. But that view is becoming ever more prevalent.
See, the one political development I think I've been right about all year, this has been my one redeeming moment in a year of unremitting failure as a prognosticator, was that I didn't think that Leave would win, but I did think it was mostly a vote about immigration, and I think I've been proved more or less correct about that. Final thought on this one, Kathleen. How popular is Theresa May likely to be at this summit? I mean, I guess, is there any reason why the rest of the EU should make this easy for the UK?
No, although she seems to get along quite well with Angela Merkel. Gosh, they're a little bit alike, are they not? Both scientists, shall we start? It's interesting. First of all, what needs to happen is the Tory party needs to lose a series of by-elections. So questions are being asked. Secondly, she's going to have to hope that Liam Fox doesn't start briefing against her. You see, because enemies like that of which she must be frightened. I think they're going to be happy that it's her rather than Michael Gove, for example. But it's in no one's benefit at this point in Europe to give her a good time.
Well, on that happy thought, finally tonight, you would think that those responsible for encouraging tourism to Iceland have a fairly uphill task. Quite aside from the clue in the name vis-a-vis local conditions, Iceland is remote, riotously expensive, generally has either too much or not enough daylight, and the national dish is fermented shark chunks which smell like sink-on blocker. This decade especially, however, Iceland has enjoyed an astonishing tourist boom. By the end of the year, 2 million people will have holidayed there in 2016, more than 6 tourists for every actual Icelander. Mary, you have been, as have I, but we will get to that. You have been. What did you like about it? What would you recommend about Iceland?
Yes, well, my husband and I were among all these millions of tourists this past summer. We went on a cruise ship and we went around Iceland with 4 stops and 2 days in Reykjavik. And it was absolutely wonderful because I think one of the attractions of Iceland is that it's like nowhere else.
This is true.
And one of the things that you didn't mention was that among the things that it doesn't have and does have, it has all these wonderful sort of peculiar landscape and hot springs and geological all sorts of things. But it has no trees except in Reykjavik. And it's really strange to be in a landscape where you realise when you get back to the UK, suddenly there are trees everywhere. You realise how abnormal this was.
All jokes aside, it is a beautiful place to look at, weird and otherworldly though it is. Kathleen, why do you think it has suddenly become so incredibly popular, though, especially with Americans? Its tourist numbers have tripled in the last 6 years.
Well, first of all, of course, there are some fairly popular crime writers that have come out of Iceland, so that probably introduced an awful lot of people to that. Secondly, there have been more photographs of the Northern Lights coming on, and in Iceland is a bit closer than Norway.
They are crediting the Instagram effect to a large extent.
Well, it's the volcano, of course, which trapped me in a place in rural America for a week when I wanted to come back home.
This was the volcano, well,
which
the,
I can't pronounce.
Yeah, I wasn't even going to try.
The cloud.
I've got it written down here, but no, I don't fancy it. We all remember it though. 2010.
I have been to Reykjavik. I remembered. I was thinking I hadn't. In my hot youth, when I was a student, the only way you could fly back to America that wasn't full fare was Icelandic Airways, and they had to refuel in Reykjavik. And I can remember walking across the tarmac with my backpack and holes in my shoes, and my foot sticking to it. At every step. That's my real introduction to Reykjavik. My sister, who's been there, says the water is extraordinary, clear and clean.
It does smell quite funny.
Ah, I must tell my sister that.
She was obviously on the sulphurous side.
I was last there last December on assignment for Monocle magazine, in fact. And it is what does take getting used to, or at least far more getting used to than I could summon, was the fact that if you get up at sort of 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning, it's going to be dark for another 3 hours. And then the sun comes up shortly before lunchtime and then sets again at about 4 p.m. That would be hard, I think.
That's why the Icelandic alcoholism problem is so high. They share this with the Finns.
It's also how they develop the whole tradition of the sagas and the oral tradition of woodworking, all these things that you do in the
around
long
the
dark
fire.
And around the fire in the long dark nights. I'm much more familiar with places like St. Petersburg, which has exactly the same winter thing. But I think there is, in some ways, there's a virtue about seeing countries like this and seeing how people have adjusted to what we think are really very, very difficult conditions.
Well, I'm Australian, and I think that about Londoners. Kathleen Burke and Mary Dijewski, thank you both very much for joining us at Midori House. We will have to leave it there. That is all for today's episode. It was produced by Ben Ryland, research by Gaia Lutz. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. There's more music next. At 1900, we'll explore the world cities with the urbanist, and we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening and goodbye.